When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Are you ready? It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne Comics.
Welcome to episode 333 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. It's time for another doubleheader episode, as I have two great indie comics creators talking about their projects and how you can access them. First up is the return of Tyler Chin Tanner, and he's got a great Kickstarter going on right now for an anthology book called All We Ever Wanted, Stories of a Better World. He's doing real well as of this recording, and I expect good things from this anthology. So we discuss what it's about, and we get into who's involved, as well as when we can see this wonderful anthology coming out. Then, for the first time with the podcast, we talk with Jay Gillespie, who creates Severed Souls, The Order of the Revenant, which is a terrific series I saw at Fan Days Dallas. He discusses what the story's about the influence the supernatural might have had on history and individuals in it, and where some powers might come from. Magic, psychic energy, those kinds of things. He delves into that and makes a really convincing case that might have something to do with reality. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Okay, it's always great to talk with Tyler Chin Tanner from A Wave Blue World, and who has a new Kickstarter going for an anthology called All We Ever Wanted, Stories for a Better World. And how you doing, Tyler?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's always good to talk with you. The last time I saw you, I think it was Seattle, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you were up there, weren't you, just this past March?
Right? Yeah, we were up there, and we were promoting Stabbity Bunny up that way. It was a weird situation because normally we have a booth, you know, and we're there all the time. This was a case where we actually didn't have a booth, but we were helping. We were there a couple hours a day at the CGC booth, which was really weird. Never done that before.
Oh.
And so we were there. We come in on a couple hours, and then we leave, and then we go. It was really weird. We actually got to go to the convention, which is unusual.
Right.
So we saw you there. You had a booth.
Comics?
We were selling comics. Yeah, we sold a lot of comics, to be honest with you. It was stunning how many we sold that day, especially because we were only there like 2 or 3 hours a day.
Right.
It was stunning. Of course, at that time, you have to remember what happened was Stabbity had just come out, and there were a lot of people desperate to find copies of 1 and 2, and we had 1 and 2 with us, so we sold a lot.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's always good to have a good buzz.
Yeah, it's really great stuff. So, let's see. All We Ever Wanted, Stories of a Better World, not for.
Yeah.
I got that wrong. So I want to make sure you get that right, because somebody types that in, they might not get it in Kickstarter. I mean, underscore here says a full-color comics anthology with a positive vision of the future featuring top-level talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why don't you describe a little bit of what it is?
The idea is that we want to do a sci-fi anthology of a positive future, like something to be hopeful, to look forward to, the Star Trek kind of idea, rather than the Mad Max. You know, these are technology and advancements are helping a better world. There's more acceptance and inclusion and, you know, everything that we've always wanted in the future, like what we should be moving forward towards, you know, these are stories about reaching those goals. It doesn't necessarily mean there's no more conflict or it's perfect utopian, but just the idea that we're moving in the right direction rather than all is lost. Because I feel like the dystopian theme has been so prevalent lately for good reason as sort of like this warning. But I feel like we've almost taken a turn so bad that we need to sort of reestablish the hope. Like, you know, we can do this. Mm-hmm. You know, let's pull together and, you know, lift our spirits a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because my understanding is that before Star Trek, which was in the 60s, a lot of it was very dark sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Really, really dark. And that's why it made Star Trek stand out, was because there was something different. I mean, here was this positive thing of the future. You know, you go to the future and everybody go along and stuff like that. It was.
Yeah. Well, this stuff moves in cycles. You know?
Yeah, it really does. So I got to ask you, this is something that some of my friends and I get together and talk about science fiction. And we always puzzle over whether it's a science fiction is a world we want to live in or one we want to read or about or watch. Because let's face it, Next Generation was a very calm, everybody got along, no problems ever amongst on the ship and stuff like that. And then you get to Deep Space Nine, where there were a lot of troubles between the people. They weren't necessarily all from Starfleet, which allowed conflict between the characters. And right. I always tell people I'd rather live on the Enterprise D, but I'd rather watch the space station Deep Space Nine because it's more interesting. It's because of those kinds of things.
I mean, right.
What was your take on that? I mean, as far as like, because your book, see, I like to see stories that I don't know the endings of. And some people I know right away are going to go, oh, better world, don't know. Everything's going to have a positive ending to it. And so I got to ask you, does every story have a positive ending to it?
No, you know, when we put this together, we understood that conflict, you know, makes stories go. Mm-hmm. And unpredictability as well. Mm-hmm. So even though we felt the theme was something that was sorely needed, mm-hmm. something we worked on with the writers, the contributors of the anthology was, you know, you can still show how we're trying to achieve this or what we're fighting against. There needs to be some balance there. The idea isn't to create utopias and everything's like, oh, well, what would we do in a utopia? Oh, just sing songs and be merry. Like, that's not the idea at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think even in the examples you gave, the more positive ones, I mean, there's still going to be conflict in the show. There's a plot like, all right, well, you know, even though we've reached a point in society where things are fairly positive, things keep coming up, mm-hmm. you know, problems, and like, we will solve these, you know. So the idea is more of like, okay, like, things haven't just completely fallen apart. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever your situation is, like, you know, for people's just day-to-day life, mm-hmm. you know, even when everything's going well, you're going to be like, oh, but the bus was late. How awful, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. all relative. Whereas, you know, if society is broken down, you have greater concerns than your bus being late. But in the same way, story conflicts, it's like, all right, you can have the entire world is going to be destroyed, mm-hmm. or you can have, like, one person out of a large group is causing trouble for everybody, so let's figure that out or solve that problem. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all just relevant stories. It's just a question of what the greater landscape mm-hmm. you're dealing with is.
It's put together real well on the Kickstarter page, which, by the way, if you go to All We Ever Wanted at Kickstarter.com, you'll find it there. It says, the book's packed with 25-plus stories meant to inspire us and restore the belief that a better world is possible.
Right.
Which I like that. I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Right there. Yeah, so, that was a good line.
Like, yeah, I think that's really well done for that. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything's going to be hunky-dory all the time. You've got to have, like you're saying, conflict is the essence of drama. And that was one of the troubles I had with Next Generation, was that there often wasn't a lot of drama. There was a lot of discussion, but there wasn't a lot of things going on. See, that's what I loved about Deep Space Nine. There was a lot more action, a lot more adventure, as far as I could tell with it. Now, would I want to live on the space station? No. It's a lot much safer to sit on a starship that's shuttling ambassadors and biogenic materials and stuff like that. That's a lot safer place to be. But on the other hand, I'd rather read about that. So hopefully your books, your stories all have a balance between those kinds of things.
Yeah, and the ones we've been able to read so far are doing a really good job. And it's interesting to see the different directions people take. There's a good amount of them that have reached a point where sort of nature has retaken over you know? So, you know, something bad has happened in the past. Like, we've almost, like, moved through this apocalyptic time period, and nature is kind of growing in and allowed for, you know, better approaches to living to reemerge.
So I got to ask, too, there's another famous trope that sci-fi goes into, is that, and that is that humans are bad in the universe, or bad influence in the universe. Do you guys deal with that trope at all, one way or another?
Yeah, I think a lot of stories deal with that and different responses. I think that a lot of them are sort of saying, like, where we are right now is kind of a tipping point. You know, like, are we going to make that a priority? Like, we understand people leave footprints, but do you do things in a way that, you know, is sustainable? So I think that's sort of the way that it's dealt with, because I mean, I don't think we have any stories that are like the eradication of the human race is the best option. That would be a little bit too negative, but we have some stories where it's like, all right, our society has just moved together and forward. Like the one that I'm writing is kind of a little bit more like that, where like, okay, we've accomplished this as a group. Then there are other ones that are like, all right, we've got to learn our lessons first. You know, and have some sort of corrections, and you know, people suffer from that before they realize the importance of taking care of nature and animals and the world around them.
Right. So, in other words, you're doing what I hope in a book like that is you get variety.
Yeah, there's definitely been a strong variety, and myself and the two editors, Matt Miner and Eric Palicki, have really been reading over things and making sure that there's enough variety, that everyone's not trying to do the same story. And we've been pleasantly surprised that it hasn't taken too much coaxing at all, that just what people have been coming up with are very different.
Cool, because oftentimes I'll read about like an anthology and it gets darker and darker and darker and darker. And by the end of it, I get, you know, I have to go watch a cartoon in order to put myself back up. But I like it with more variety, like what you're talking about.
And I think we're going to have some good variety in here in terms of just how dark and light. There are some stories that are like really deal with the whole, like, all right, we're on the edge of like darkness here. And, you know, I think we have one of the images on our Kickstarter campaign shows somebody out there with a flamethrower, like battling robots and things like that. And then you'll have just, you know, a little bit calmer stories that deal with personal conflicts in a new world. You know, it's like, well, what, you know, I think there was one that one of the main pitches was like, in a world where everybody is accepted, you know, where do you draw the line on sort of, I don't know, who you are, you know? Mm-hmm. Can you still be an individual and unique? Mm-hmm. You know, so, cool. Yeah. Needing to fight robots for survival and, you know, am I still unique in a world where everyone's accepted?
Yeah, because, see, I like that kind of stuff because I don't want to, you know, like I was talking about the business about discussion versus action and adventure. That's another balance I hope you guys like to strike, because I don't mind it if sometimes it's people are talking about an issue. But on the other hand, I don't want that every time. I want to get, like, adventure sometimes. I don't know if you have many ray guns or if you have, you know, the old sci-fi staple or any of those kinds of things. I'm just kind of curious as to, I'll be fascinated to see what kinds of things you do in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got some interesting stuff. And I think we've shown some examples on the Kickstarter page itself. You can see, you know, we have a little bit of variety there on just what we're talking about.
Now, it's interesting to me that it says on the Kickstarter page, curated and edited by Matt Miner. What does curated mean as far as that
goes? Matt Miner and Eric Palicki, yeah.
Yeah.
So curated would refer mostly to that the anthology was chosen. The creators were sort of handpicked. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just sort of an open send us everything. Mm-hmm. So I think those two, I mean, I was involved in that process as well, but sort of deciding who gets in. And I guess the editing part would then be, all right, some guidance on what we're doing and does your story fit and what direction is the story taking? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'd say those two words refer to.
Because I've often talked with you, and you're the one doing the, I guess we want to use the word curating and editing and stuff like that. Some of the books that I've talked with you in the past, you've been doing that. Is this different now? Is this a different role for you?
Slightly different. So it's our first anthology I did, Broken Frontier. Mm-hmm. Frederick Houghton was the, I think I'm pronouncing a very English version of that. He was a co-editor. He sort of brought in a lot of the talent, and I sort of pulled the book together. So there was a balance there. Loved and Lost was more of my own pet project, mm-hmm. where I really, you know, chose the artists because they were the stories that I wrote. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I worked with these two editors on This Nightmare Kills Fascists, the anthology we did before this, mm-hmm. and they had kind of come together and created that project, and I said, I'll come in and publish it. Mm-hmm. So we did this one. I wanted a little bit more of a role from the beginning just to oversee things. But yeah, I'm sort of taking more of the executive role where I'm aware of everything that's going on and sort of being an influence on everything. Mm-hmm. But they're the lead editors, like talking mm-hmm. to the talents and guiding how this moves forward.
So you're sort of like a Rick Berman or a Gene Roddenberry as opposed to, you know, like Ira Stephen Baer or something like that. You're more of a guider than you are, let's say, you in the nuts and bolts every day.
Well, I'm certainly in there every day. I try to take a more removed, like bigger picture, you know, like I'm really just making sure that each step is leading us to creating a great book that I can put out on the market, you know. Sort of a, I don't know, yeah, more of a publisher, marketer, like, you know, are we creating a product that we want to sell, you know, here?
Okay.
Not that it's all just about sales figures or whatever. I don't want to make a beautiful book, but yeah, just sort of taking that kind of view on it.
I guess I'm just not used to seeing your name. It says edited by Miner and Palicki. I'm used to seeing your name in there someplace, and that's why I'm a little thrown by it.
Let me tell you, it's nice to have some other people in there with you. It's a big undertaking to do a project like this. So, it's been amazing to have those two there as well. And we've just been, you know, supporting each other through this process and getting creators on it. You know, and I'm writing a story in this, which I'm excited for. So. Mm-hmm. Definitely got plenty to do.
Cool, because I've interviewed Eric on this podcast before.
Okay.
He's done some great stuff. I always love his stuff. I haven't done Mr. Miner yet, but I hope to at some point. But I'm just kind of fascinated by it. And I got to ask, the cover, it shows like a girl with a head balloon on, and she's chewing bubble gum inside, and it's expanding the thing. I guess that's a good way to say, because it's showing that even like a headgear like that, that'll still expand. It won't. She can do those kinds of things inside there,
right?
Which I like, because normally you see that it's very restrictive. You cannot move your head around in those kinds of things. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, the good question is: does the helmet have room for her to blow a bubble regularly, or does it move? Does it change shape when she blows a bubble? That would be an interesting question to ask. But yeah, I see what you mean.
Ariella Cristantina.
Cristantina,
I hope I pronounced that right. I'm terrible with people's names, and so I'm always trying to. I always have to tell my J.T. Cruel story, that when he was introduced by Dan DiDio, he pronounced him as J.T. Crawl. And so everybody, including me, thought that's how you pronounced his name. And so I interviewed him on my podcast one time, and I asked him to do a little promo for me, and in it he pronounced his name as Cruel. And I got to the end, and I went, oh, my gosh. I said, I've been pronouncing your name wrong for years. He says, yeah, Dan DiDio did that to me. He goes. So I'm always on a mission to get people's names right. And I don't often always get it, but I try really hard anyway about that.
Yeah.
But so then if you're kind of overseeing the project on some levels, who's making the decision who to approach? Because it doesn't sound like you're taking just general admissions. You're approaching stuff with people.
Yeah.
How's that going? Are you involved with that, or is that the other two folks, Mr. Miner, Mr. Palicki?
Well, we're done with that. We had that figured out before we launched the campaign. But no, we all three of us talked together about that. We all had our sort of people that we wanted to tap for it. So we just sort of did a process, like, you know, is this who we want to go with? And then sometimes, like, we would get somebody and they had either an artist or a writer that they wanted to work with.
Okay.
So we would be like, okay, well, let's check this person out. And I had to, you know, vote on that person as well. And, but, you know, keeping in mind if that creator wanted to work with that other creator, then, you know, we would like for that to happen. We just had to sort of make sure.
Were there any of them that you had to kind of find an artist for, shall we say?
There was a long sort of matching up process.
Okay.
But it did come together pretty well. Mm-hmm. Towards the end, we were like, well, we got one extra writer or one extra artist, or, you know, so mm-hmm. let's find one more of this or see mm-hmm. if they have a suggestion. I think we were looking for a writer for Chris Visions, and he was like, no, I'm just going to, he just sent in a pitch. And I think we didn't even realize it at first. We're like, oh, who should write Chris Vision's story? And the next thing we know, he's like, here's my pitch. And we're like, oh, this is great. Yeah, you write your own story. So that were, you know, things like that.
That's great. Now, as I'm looking over the pages, of course, remember I was talking about action. There's a sample page from a story called Owning Up to the Past that has a lot of action involved in it. And, of course, right away I have to say, okay, it's not only going to be certain kinds of stories, you are going to have some action adventure in there, as I can tell from that one.
So that's why it's good to have that in there as well.
The different kinds of things. And I noticed too, there's a variety, as always with your projects, there's a lot of variety in styles mm-hmm. as well. Some of them are, like we talked about, the action adventure, it's a little more, I don't know how to describe it. It's just, you know, things happen in the poster. But the other ones, many of them are, something's taking place and we get to observe how it's taking place.
Yeah.
And I like that. And, you know, the variety is a good thing because, you know, some of them's a little more cartoony style. Some of them are a little more, I don't know what you want to say, TV kind of action style. Did you try really hard to provide that variety, or did it just happen that way? I doubt that it just happened. You guys must have had to come in and work with
them. You know, I don't think we thought about it too much. I think all three of us just liked different styles. I've never been like someone who liked a particular style. I'm not against cartoony. I'm not against realism. I'm not against, you know, clean line work or messy inks. I mean, if someone's doing a good job with it, you know, I like it and I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. In my reading, in the comics I read, I feel like there's a variety of art styles. And so I think we just basically went with that. I mean, if you kind of put your heads together and be like, all right, who are the people we really want on this? I would think that you should have a good variety. If not, I think you're probably a little too closed off.
Yeah. Now, the one thing I'm interested too is the fact that you've got so many creators in here. I don't know if I can mention them all as far as things go. You've got a lot of people. Some of them I know, some of them I don't. Howard Mackey, I know. Dean Trippi, I think I know. Gosh, I hate to leave out the people I don't know because they're probably going to be good people to read too. Richard Duick, I know from Gutter Magic, and other people that I know. There's a lot of good people in here. You know, I feel bad leaving out people's names because there's a lot of good people in here. You know, 25 plus stories, you must have like, that means like 50 creators roughly.
Yeah, pretty much, because there's only a couple of stories that have a single creator. But I mean, everybody can look down the list, you know. And then as per what you were saying about some that you don't know, I mean, I think that's kind of the point of a good anthology is like, the names that you do know maybe get you in the door, and then, you know, the ones you don't know, you get exposed to their work, you know, some get to learn some new artists by reading the anthology. Mm-hmm. You get to see what they do.
Which is always good. I was like, of course, Wendy Chintanner's in there too. Yep. That's a name I recognize.
Yeah.
So that's a good one. Yeah, that's good. So
I've co-written with her before, but I've never been on a project where we write our own stories. Mm-hmm. You know, she's mostly a poet and a fiction writer, but she's had her experience with comics through me, through a co-writing and editing my own scripts. So
where is the project right now? I mean, obviously you're in a Kickstarter. It's going to end, according to the website, it's going to be over on July the 4th, noon. Boy, that's an interesting question. Are you Canadian? Are you Canadian by any chance?
Yeah.
Are you? No. You're not. Okay. No. You're in New York.
Yeah, I'm in New York, okay. And I'll be in Connecticut on 4th of July.
Okay, alrighty. So this was this chosen for a reason? I mean, some folks I know, like folks in other countries, choose July the 4th because they figure people have nothing better to do on July the 4th. But, you know, down here in America, it's a little different. So I'm just kind of curious as to why you chose that day as a concluding date.
I don't really expect many people to be on their computer on July 4th. June 4th, it was more based off of the starting date and just to do 30 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's made sense to start yesterday around noon because that's a good, you know, start right at the beginning of the week and have that full first week. Mm-hmm. But then when I saw it, it ended on July 4th. I was like, well, that will be fine. Just sort of end on that day.
Sometimes that's a good thing to end on a holiday like that, because what will happen is people, let's say they're not necessarily... You know, you're not tied up with work on that day or something like that. It gives you a chance to kind of go in at the last second and dive on and help.
Right, yeah.
Which is a good thing. So that's a good thing. So anyway, it's going to end on July the 4th around noon. Mm-hmm. And how's the project coming right now? Because, boy, this is a lot of moving parts. You know, it might take three of you guys to keep all the 50 Think creators all going in the right direction.
It is a lot of moving parts. So we came up with some deadlines, and the June 1st was the first script deadline. Now, a couple of people got extensions on that to the mid-June. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we've gotten scripts, and you can see, obviously, by the samples that some artists are already working on the scripts, mm-hmm. ones that came in early. And then our deadline for the art is the end of August.
Okay.
We're hoping we get all of that in there, and then some colors and some lettering and some production, and we'll get this off the print.
Wow.
And it looks like we said January, which I hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, if we can even get this out a little bit before, if we could do the end of the year, that would be great, but if not, January is our...
If you can get this out by around before Christmas.
Yeah.
What would that be a nice thing?
We'll shoot for that for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, if you can't, you can't. It's better to do it right than do it early. So yeah. I think that's a good thing to do. So, well, you've got some good people in there, and I encourage people, if when you're looking things over, look over the people who are contributing and being a part of this. And you might recognize names that I don't off the top of my head, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. The artwork intrigues me, and the stories kind of fascinate me. So I'm just thinking this is going to be one of those great holiday gifts. If it's not, then it's a birthday gift, and it's one of those things. Now, I also want to talk about the fact that you've got a variety of rewards on there as well, and I think that's kind of nicely done.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to overcomplicate it, but you can get the book, you know, digitally or in print. Mm-hmm. The editors and I offer book packs with previous works that we've done. We have a signed book plate, mm-hmm. a couple versions that different limits. One has 50 copies, one is 25, and then some sketches. Mm-hmm. You know, four of the artists involved offered to do a sketch.
And you have a book pack in there.
Yes.
Some of your stuff's included in there too, so I think that's kind of fun. I mean, do you get to choose which books you want as far as that goes? Did you kind of figure some things people interested in this project might be more interested than, say, interested in something else?
Well, that's why I chose the Broken Frontier anthology, because it was sci-fi related. I also listed This Nightmare, mm-hmm. Which is more of the horror one. But, you know, someone can always be like, I backed your last anthology, so I don't need that one. Mm-hmm. And I can probably send something else along.
Cool.
You know? So, yeah.
Now, I'm interested. One of your rewards is already sold out.
For the cover art?
Yeah. Wow. That was a $420 level, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's a bargain for the cover art, though.
Wow, that's great. I mean, for $420, yeah. You know, not everybody who can help a Kickstarter can afford a $420 level. But, boy, if you've gotten that, and that's already gone, that's a big help.
Yeah, we got off to a good start, for sure. We got some big rewards going early, and it's kept up pretty well. So you just have to kind of make it through the 30 days and hope we get there sooner rather than later.
Here we go, the daily heart attack.
Yeah, I know. It's such a stress.
Did anybody donate today? Oh, no, why not? Oh, what did we do wrong? We don't have anybody today. You know, yeah. And then they always say weekends are the hardest because weekends are when people tend to go off and do other things and don't necessarily spend time on their computer looking at Kickstarter projects.
Right.
So that's when the sweat starts to form and people start to worry. Now, your goal is $20,000. As we're recording this, the Kickstarter is underway, but you're about a third of the way there, roughly. So I'm expecting good things. This is only a couple days into it.
Yeah, we launched yesterday at noon, so we're, 32 hours in?
Wow.
Yeah.
You're already at this point. Of course, it'll be different when this posts on Sunday, but you've got 142 backers.
Yeah.
That's a lot of backers.
That's pretty good, yeah.
In a little over a day. So you're doing a good job on this good stuff, too. So I think that's just wonderful how this is going to go. I like the fact that you, not only within the book itself, the anthology itself, have variety, but your projects also tend to have a lot of variety to them.
Yeah, I like to do different things.
Yeah, not everybody does that. There are some people who are Western people, and all they do is write Western stories, and there are people who like crime drama, and that's their niche, and that's where they're comfortable, and so they won't go other places. But I like the fact that you and your folks like to do different kinds of things. And because someone like me, if I get an anthology and it's all the same story kind of being retold multiple times, I'm not going to make it through the whole book, I hate to tell you. So this kind of book will keep me all the way through. Speaking of which, do you know how many pages are going to be in this book?
Going to be around the 176 mark,
okay,
I think.
That's good.
Just from publishing, I know that that's one of the signature, adds up to, when you're printing.
Is this a trade or a hardcover?
Right now, it's a soft cover.
Okay.
It's possible that we may get to the point with stretch goals that we'll consider a hardcover, but I don't want to get into that just yet.
Okay.
Let's just focus on the initial goal.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, the initial goal is just for a soft cover.
Well, you've had some pretty good success with Kickstarter, so I'm pretty certain you're going to have pretty good success with this one. I'm anxious to see that you get to the stretch goals and what kind of good things you offer with those. So those will be fun to do. And you've got several creators to pick from, I'm sure, who'll be willing to help make things happen. Now, I got this Nightmare Kills Fascists up at Seattle, which was a great book. You know, talk about variety there. That was a good one, too. I like that one. So I think you guys do a lot of good things, and this one is going to be tremendous stuff. I just think it's going to go over big. So I think people are going to really love it.
Yeah, it's going to be a great book. I mean, I can just say that, removing myself and looking at it and what the creators are doing.
Yeah.
Everything that's coming up. I'm excited for it.
Great, great. So not far off, of course, like we said, Wednesday, July the 4th, around noon. If you haven't done it by then, you better make sure you get in there before.
That's right.
So get in and make it happen. So I know this has got you tied up right now, but are there other projects that you're working on?
Oh, a bunch, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I have an art book debuting at HeroesCon. I don't know if you're going down to HeroesCon this year.
Yeah, I'll be at HeroesCon.
Oh, yeah? All right. Well, we're debuting Chris Bruner and Rico Renzi's art book called The Kids Stick Together. Mm. And that'll be... Jeez, in a week, when this goes live, less than a week, it'll be that week.
Wow.
So that'll be a lot of fun. It's great to have both a debut book and a Kickstarter at the same time, because it's like, well, this one is, really coming out, and here's one that, will come out next. I've also got later in Boston in August, I've got the Kismet Volume 1 collection coming out.
Mm-hmm.
That was been on our website. We've been posting the pages as we finish that one. And then the same thing with Phantom of the Opera, the graphic novel adaptation, is going to debut at New York Comic Con.
Wow.
So, yeah, quite a few things. And I'm already trying to line up 2019's titles. So, we'll stay busy.
Wow. That's great. Of course, that means that you're doing a good job because, you've got all these irons in the fire. And I always like it when that kind of stuff goes. And I'm sure there are some projects you can't talk about at this point that are possibles. So we won't go delve into that stuff. But it just sounds like you're doing a great job and lots of good things are going. I got one last question for you.
Sure.
If you go to the Kickstarter page, the very first thing, one of the very first things you see is a video. And it's you talking about the project. And there's a younger girl sitting reading something, apparently uninterested in what you're talking about. Is that your daughter by any chance?
Yes, it is. It's my daughter.
Gosh, she's grown. I think I saw her a long time ago at, was it C2E2? I'm trying to remember where it was. I first met you. I think I saw her there. And I was like, and I look at her and go, wow, it's been a while.
Her first convention, she was 4 months old. That was San Diego, the year she was born. And she's 11 now.
Wow.
So most of the shows I go to, she loves it. And she draws now and does commissions.
Oh, cool. So maybe there might be another Chin Tanner in there someday when you're anthology.
There might just be. We'll see.
Wow.
You gotta make her work for it, though. No easy ride. Not coasting in.
Yeah, she can't run on her name only. That's the thing. Yeah. She's got to do other stuff. Oh. Well, it looks like she's having fun doing it, and it was kind of funny how she did that. So I thought that was kind of entertaining. I just had to know for sure, because you don't identify who she is in there. Right? So I thought I better ask that just because I'm curious, and I think other people might be curious too. Well, Tyler, you're doing a wonderful job, as always. It's All We Ever Wanted, Stories of a Better World, and it's going on right now at Kickstarter. I highly recommend it. It looks really tremendous, and I can't wait to see the stories you're going to tell and all the other good projects you've got coming too. Just not just that. So, Tyler, please keep it up. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I'll be keeping it up for sure. Thanks for having me. Thanks for continuing to have me on your show.
Always. No problem.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
In a world where the supernatural has its roots in our history and could explain the mysteries of our time, one girl will manifest a power so great it must remain hidden. But when someone she loves is taken, she will be forced to reveal her true power and awaken an ancient evil that will stop at nothing to take it from her. What would it mean to be born with an ancient soul? Find out in Severed Souls. Available now.
It's great to talk with Jay Gillespie, the creator of Severed Souls, a series of comics that I really enjoy. That's very interesting and very gripping storytelling. How are you doing today, Jay?
I'm doing great, Wayne. Thank you very much.
Jay, it's good to talk with you. I met you back at Fan Days Dallas, if I remember correctly. And you were at a booth right across from where I was, and I got to pick up your book there, and I really liked it. It's something really interesting. Now, the thing I have to talk about, though, is how much of this book you do. I mean, the only thing I think you don't do is print it.
That's about right. I started out to do a graphic novel, and it was going to be probably 80 or 100 pages, but the story just kind of took on a life of its own, and it expanded. And I don't want to get other talent too much involved unless I can pay, and it's not something I can do yet, but I'm definitely open to it. I started writing the story a long time ago, and I finally started publishing the issues in 2016, but from cover to cover, I'm doing the writing and the arting and lettering and everything so far.
Wow. Now, of course, it's black and white. Is that a financial choice to do it in black and white?
Financial for printing, and also expediency for time, because it adds like a whole other phase. Like instead of being able to do two pages a week, it might turn out to be one page a week if I'm going all the way I would want to color it. If I just added accents of colors here and there, maybe different, but I'd want to do a really nice job. So I just said, well, I'm going to skip that part and just do black and white. And since then, I've had a lot of people look at it and say, oh man, keep it black and white. I really like it this way. And so now I'm in a quandary. I'd love to have a colorist, though. That'd be great.
Well, if you could ever put it like a collected edition out, that would be the time to color.
Yeah, like a trade. Yeah, that would. And I got 5 issues, so I'm really maybe even past that point where I should probably do one. But I would love to get it colored at that point, yeah.
I always think of Bone. They had a black and white when it first came out. And then when they started re-releasing them in like little hardcover editions, they were color. And I had to say I bought as many of those as I could find because I liked seeing the color the way that it was done. And I think that your book, too, would really lend itself well to color.
Thanks. I would like to do that. Yeah. So maybe soon.
Okay. Now, before we get too far into the book, I want to talk about the fact that you have a Patreon, right?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Why don't you talk about that and tell how people can sign up for the Patreon?
Yeah, it's great. What I wanted was a way that people could follow the story, one, or if they want to get copies of the book when they're ready. They're coming out pretty consistently about every 4 or 5 months. I'm shooting for 3 or 4, but in conventions and everything, that gets slowed down. But there's different levels that you can contribute to on the Patreon, where I think like the $3 per month level is the one that gets you a signed copy of the book mailed to you without any additional charge whenever it's released. Because after about 4 or 5 months, you've got enough money that it covers the cost, and then it covers the mailing. And I always throw in extras too, just because. So there's that level, but the levels go up from there. If there's commission work you'd like to get periodically, there's higher levels for that.
Cool.
So it's severedsoulsbook.com. It just takes you right to the Patreon.
Oh, very cool. Okay. So that's a good thing to do. So that'll keep it going. Now, I saw you at a convention, as I said. I imagine you're doing a lot of conventions these days to try to get the word out about it.
That's right.
What cons do you have coming up before we dive in the book?
Coming up is an inaugural Comic-Con called Greater Austin Comic-Con in Austin, Texas.
Oh, really?
Some real great guys are putting that con on, and I'm pretty excited about it. And there's you can kind of tell there's a little buzz around the con, and there seems to be really great energy for this one. So that's June 16 and 17.
Wow.
They're starting off great, you know. I've heard of others that started in really, really small venues, and fortunately for them, it grew. But these guys are a great response already, so it's a pretty decent-sized venue. And then the week right after that is the second-year convention for Corpus Christi Con, and I went to their con last year, which was their inaugural, and I didn't know what to expect going in, and it was great. It was a great experience, and it's run by great people. So I got two coming up back-to-back. And then, let's see, after that, there's Bell County Comic-Con, which was also inaugural last year. Mm-hmm. Another great con. There's Fandemic Tour coming up. So, yeah, there's a bunch. And Alamo City Comic-Con as well.
Are those all in Texas, seems like?
These are primarily Texas local conventions. Dallas Fan Days, where you and I ran into each other, was probably the largest con I've ever been to. And it was a huge turnout, and you know, I would really like to expand out and, you know, hit some more conventions outside of the state, but you know, I have to be sure that I've covered expenses and right. You know, so just for now I keep it mostly local where I can drive, and anything in certain areas of Texas I have friends or family where I can crash, so it's easy to, you know, make that without too much expense. So it's just grassroots, you know, starting out.
It's interesting because I never knew Texas was a comic place very much, but that's kind of cool.
It's funny, yeah, because I put in my books, you know, I know you're out there. You know, there's just got to be other creators. And, you know, so part of my mission has been to find, you know, the comic scene and the comic creators. And it's lifting back the curtain. There's a lot. And there's way more in Houston than you might think. So there's, you know, lots of self-publishers and lots of creators who've written their own stories. A lot of artists, some professionals that live in the Houston area that I didn't even know they were here. And some in Austin as well. So I can name a few, but I don't know if I should do that.
Leave some, invariably leave somebody out, and I always hate to do that.
Yeah, you're right.
Those kinds of things. But it was like, when I moved to Florida, I thought I'm moving out to the boonies. Nobody's going to read comics. There won't be a comic shop for hundreds of miles kind of stuff. And when I got here, I was really surprised to discover there are all these little comic companies making comics and lots of stores all over the place. I was really, really surprised. So it's nice to hear that you don't necessarily have to be in New York City in order to be able to get a and have a comic community that that's when you can deal
with. There's a really great comic community. And it's one of the things that is actually really good about going to the local cons, because anybody who lives away, not as close to the more major cities like Houston and Dallas, anybody else has to travel to get to any conventions. So when they do them in some of the smaller cities, wow, the turnout and the response from people, the enthusiasm, it's always great. It has surprised me many times to the local shows. They're great.
It's fantastic to hear that, because, you know, I always think that I'm going into the boonies, the places where nobody's ever been before with a comic. And because I grew up in a small town where very few people actually read comics, and I got sort of ridiculed because I was a comic guy. But now what's funny is to go back to that town and to see all these people rushing in to see all the comic book related movies, long lines, and the people who used to ridicule us now are standing in line to go see those comic book movies. I find that funny.
I know. Well, I don't know. I guess the more that, you know, the comic, scene can be contributed to and grow, the better. And, you know, I encourage all the creativity and everyone who's out there with a story to tell. Mm-hmm. So I hope for more.
Me too. I think that indie comics are one of the best sources of storytelling, because you're not limited. You know, it's Batman has to be back next issue. You know,
yeah.
With Severed Souls, you might change your cast as you go along the way. Something might happen, and it might make things a little different as things go forward.
That's true. I always look at it as a sandbox, and it's fun to just play in and like, oh, here's another great idea. But you're right. I mean, I have the flexibility. There's a lot I can try, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, that's a great thing. Now, why don't we dive into the book, Severed Souls. Why don't you give us a description of what Severed Souls is about?
It's a kind of a description explanation why supernatural gifts exist and why people have powers. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, you know, for a long time tried to understand what is it that you know, what's a new kind of power or what have you. But I realized an explanation is probably the best. And it's that individuals have supernatural gifts that are attributable to the age of their soul. So it kind of ties into the folklore belief or, you know, maybe there's more out there than we understand about souls that sometimes return. And people remember past lives that they've lived or have a vivid dream about some experience of another lifetime. So I said, you know, I thought about it, and like the more their soul has lived, the more lifetimes they lived, the more powerful their gift may be. And it could explain anything from psychic powers, telekinetic gifts, magic or witchcraft or any number of things. So anyone with an ancient soul, not only are they very powerful with the supernatural gift, but they may have also lived as famous people from history who you may recognize or are the explanation for historical events, mythology, or the reason folklore, you know, the origin of folklore and archetypal creatures. I mean, it really could be anything. So I realized, like, this is a lot to write. And I only scratched the surface because I'm only one person. But there's, you know, for me, like, there's so many things that you can cover. And so in thinking about it more, eventually, there'll be a deeper dive into dimensions and characters who hop between dimensions. And so I'm kind of thinking that there's no bookend. It can go back as far as you want or go as far into other worlds as you want. And so, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's very fun to imagine.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about who the characters are in Severed Souls, because I got the first book, and it starts out with a lady kind of doing meditation, and then she gets interrupted. Talk about them. Who are they to start with?
It's a teaser about two souls that have really lived very ancient lives. They're part of a group called the Nephilim, and the Nephilim are mentioned in the Old Testament of the Bible. And kind of what I write in about the Nephilim is that they were a real thing, but there were ancient souls among the group who made them appear as giants, as they're described in the Bible by the Israelites, and that they were also described as dark fallen angels of God. And there's a whole history about the Nephilim. Kind of what I like to do in these cases is write in an explanation for why it was perceived that way in those times. Mm-hmm. And so, that's what's interesting about Tyria and about Canaan, who appear in the beginning of those books, is that Canaan was the leader for probably 4 or 5 decades of the Nephilim until Tyria actually returned. And so she's back, and he's having to, you know, the way that works, the power structure, if you're the elder ancient, you automatically are the one who's in charge. So she's back, she's in charge, and Canaan's a little miffed by that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I really like the way that starts out. It kind of sets the tone for it. And then we move into a character that I really like, a teenage girl. Talk about her. I think it's Beth. Tell us her story.
Well, Beth is the way that I like to treat every character is they can be born as anyone, anywhere in the world, any race, ethnicity, nationality, doesn't matter. I thought about giving her a really original, different, unique, strange name, but I was like, no, she's just a girl. She's just a person. And so she's born with an extraordinarily ancient soul. And as the stories move on, you will learn a little bit about who she was in past lives and how her powers were a little different in other past lives. But the way this works is that, you know, the older your soul is, the more powerful you are. So imagine someone who's really young and they are bombarded by powerful psychic gifts they can't even control. She can't keep it out. A lot of psychics are trying to channel more psychic energy to pick up more information, but she's kind of the opposite of that. She's trying to block it out because it's just constantly bombarding her. Mm-hmm. And she's able to do things like look at a person's soul. So if you're trying to convince her of something, she can see right away that there's something darker about you because she can see your soul. It even goes so far as to, like, if she touches certain things or sits in a very public place, she might pick up on all the energy around her that the rest of us would not perceive. So she has to be very careful about, you know, how she makes decisions in everyday life, because she just doesn't want to pick up on certain things. Mm-hmm. She's just an extraordinarily powerful psychic who's otherwise just wanting to be a regular person and not deal with all this. Mm-hmm. So
what I got a kick was that when we see her and her mother, they're going to talk to a police officer, and the police officer kind of dismisses all this stuff, you know, any of the supernatural stuff out of hand. But then as she's leaving the office, she says something to him that nobody else could possibly know about the fact that he lost somebody.
Yeah.
And that's what motivated him to become a detective. And I just thought that was a really great way for you to show what she's capable of.
That was the idea. It's an introduction for her. I tried to do that for some of the characters, give them a good introduction, but also try to keep the pace of the story moving along. That's exactly it. It was just to show, like, in some ways, a normal person might find her to be kind of odd, but that there are some very original, unique things about her.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we get to a character called is it Menace? Is that how you pronounce it? Menace?
Yes. I pronounce it Menace. I've read in the research that some historians may think that he was a one of the line of kings from Crete, known as Minos, and that when he came to Egypt, and this is all actual history from about 5,000 years ago, that the way that they wrote it in the ancient language was just M-N and then like a dash S or apostrophe S, not an English apostrophe, but you know what I mean. So the way that it's been spelled out in more Greek languages, M-E-N-E-S. And to me, one of the things that I wanted to tie into, you know, ancient rulers of the past, but I didn't really want to do Egypt because so many other storylines tie, you know, back to Egypt. I want to be more original. But then it popped in my head one day. It was like, wait a minute. I was watching a documentary or something, and it was like, who was the first pharaoh? Because that kind of changed everything. Mm-hmm. Dynasties began in Egypt, and people stopped having in Egypt. They stopped having just a king, but more of someone that they worshipped as a god king. So there had to be something really unique there. And that's when I started to study up on the history. Anybody can look it up. It's an actual individual. You know, I interpreted the pronunciation as Menes and worked him in as, at first he was benevolent and then he went bad and he becomes the main antagonist of the entire story. And I liked the name because it sounds like the English word menace. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, this is just too good. And there was too many tie-ins and good stuff. So I was like, all right, I didn't want to go that way, but I'm going to do this because it sounds awesome. So,
well, I would like at the beginning of the story, you show how he manages to stay alive for as long as he does. He has to go through a procedure. And it's kind of scary, the thing that he does. I don't want to spoil it because I want people to read the book, but let's just say he does some stuff that is that you don't want to experience yourself if you can help it.
There are certain gifts that go along with just being an ancient soul. So you have your, you know, whatever the inherent gift that is usually different from life to life, but also ancients themselves can do certain things in common. And, you know, you first have to learn the nature of the gift before you can use it. So some of it is kind of terrible. And, you know, a good protagonist would probably never go or even conceive of doing any of these deeds because it's just, it's a terrible thing to do. So you wouldn't do that. But as an antagonist, Menes was the first to come across this ability. And as the history and the story of the Nephilim play out and more individuals come along who are involved with the Nephilim, he shows it and teaches it to others, although they're not supposed to use it against each other. So
this is great.
Just the one gift that he uses in the first book is really only one gift. There's several. There's many gifts that all ancients could use if they learned about it.
So, in other words, somebody may have it, but they just don't know they have it.
Right. Yeah, kind of like that. But you'd have to go to kind of a dark place to use some of them. Some of them not so much. Like I mentioned, eventually some of the characters may begin dimension hopping. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that may be part of the ancient gift that some of them are able to attain. But not maybe not everybody, but, you know, some of them who are powerful enough, just by virtue of being an ancient, can pierce the veil and see other dimensions and move between them. Mm-hmm. So that one's not necessarily a terrible gift, but that's another example.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this stuff manifest itself when it's a teenager? Because that's how mutants work and stuff like that. Sometimes you're an adult when it happens. How does this work?
I would say it starts probably pretty young, maybe not like right off the bat. But, you know, when as soon as you're you know, able to perceive more of the world around you. You can imagine a kind of a mischievous little child who has a gift getting into things. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be too terribly unusual. But I think it begins to become more prevalent as the older they get and deeper, the more experiences they have in recalling things. So their teenage lives are probably, in some cases, a little troubled. Some maybe more so than others. But yeah, it probably starts fairly early and just intensifies as they get older.
And there's a great sequence, like in the third book, where there's a government agent is being questioned. A guy by the name of Frank, and he's talking about an encounter apparently with somebody who's an ancient. And they start talking and talking, and there's a guy that's asking him questions, and there's a gentleman standing next to him. When all of a sudden something happens, and that's not what we see is not necessarily what is.
Yeah, there's characters who have all various sorts of gifts. One of them can be illusions. So there's a veil that comes down during that conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like that kind of stuff. Do you have all these things planned out in your mind as far as like what powers are available, or does the story present itself and maybe you add another ability as time goes along?
I'm always adding new ones. Mm-hmm. And there's things that I initially thought like, well, you know, probably can't do that. That's more of a physical ability, not so much a mental or spiritual or, you know, supernatural kind of ability. But when you're talking about channeling energy from other worlds or other dimensions, then you can do just about really anything. So its strength could be enhanced, not so much as a physical attribute, but that you're drawing power from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Or you may ignite your hands and you don't burn because you've sheathed yourself with a veil of another dimension right around yourself so you don't burn. You know, so that if you just start thinking about it, you start coming up like, I can do all kinds of things, all kinds of gifts. But primarily the characters that are in the series one have been pretty well set and what their gifts are. And I've also thought about how the Nephilim are involved with a lot of underground crime. They're an underground organization. They don't often appear in public. They're more apocalyptic looking, so they would seem very strange in public anyway. But the Nephilim could really utilize, you know, brainwashing, any sort of strange gift you can think of, mm-hmm. in order to conduct things that are criminal activities, even human trafficking or something like that. And why some of these terrible things happen in the world has to do with those kind of things. So it's open-ended really at this point. So I don't know. It doesn't stop with just a few ideas.
Because I remember watching like the Grimm program on NBC, and they would always have these like animal souls or something that was involved. And they actually showed in the intro credits that Hitler was like a werewolf. His ability to influence people.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I found that real fascinating. So I'm interested in Beth particularly, and there's something that happens to her. One of her loved ones, something happens, and she has to get involved and try to go and resolve that situation. And she ends up in a place where suddenly it appears there's a demon that's there. But somebody interferes with what's going on. And I got a big kick out of that character, who is kind of like, it's almost like a mummy in his appearance. Yeah. Talk about that, what's going on with that. I don't want to spoil too much, but... It's a great little storyline.
More is definitely going to be revealed about him. Mm-hmm. I have a whole plan. It's bigger. It becomes a much more significant thing down the road. But for now, he's a little sidekick to Beth. I'll put it that way.
Okay. And she could use somebody to help her, or maybe kind of inform her as to what's going on with her abilities and stuff like that.
Exactly. And he has a reason. He has a purpose, but... Is also he won't interfere too much. So,
and then there's something else that as we get towards the end of number five, something happens to one of the characters that reminds me very much of a Star Trek episode where there was a guy, a young kid, had absolute power and he was able to, like, he fused just like this one lady gets her mouth fused together so she can't speak. Uh-huh. And I reminded me very much of that, and it still terrifies me even after like 34 years of seeing that. Talk about what's going on with that, because we're getting towards the end of five as we get ready for six. Can you describe a little bit what's going on in that?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get too much of a deep dive into it. A lot more will be learned as the story plays out. He has a gift that allows him to have basically molecular control or... manipulative control over molecules. So he can change the state of something. It's always been, alchemy has always tried to change like iron into gold or something like that. And he could do that, just by looking at it. And so changing the physical form or living things is a different task. because the molecules have to align just right or organs aren't going to work just right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole idea originated that if he were walking through a garden, he's so evil that everything behind him would just shrivel up and die. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a dynamic I would like to work into the book somehow at some point. Mm-hmm. But also it kind of goes to the theme of the series, which is the edge of sanity, because you can begin to think of yourself as so godlike if your gifts are so great or you were someone so powerful in a past life or what have you, that you know, what you do is so terrible, you've lost your mind. And that's kind of the point where he's reached. He has this significant ability and he has his own agenda, and the things that he's trying to do at some point is going to put pretty much everyone in danger, not just the good guys, but the bad guys too. Mm-hmm. So it's really just introducing this main antagonist, where, you know, the Nephilim have been waiting for Menes to return for so long that he's going to bring the answer to everything that the Nephilim have been waiting for. And yet once it appears he has returned, his agenda has now changed. Mm-hmm. And puts everybody pretty much at risk.
Wow. Okay. Pretty cool. Now, of course, the fifth book ends on a cliffhanger, which I won't spoil. But let's just say we see a character that we saw earlier in one of the books, and things aren't quite the way they were when we last saw this character. So I, of course, now I got to know what happens next. So I'm really anxious to go. Which leads me to the question: you got five issues out. How is number six coming along?
I think I'm on page 8 of book number 6. All the books are 28 pages. Okay. I fell on that number. It wasn't prescribed. It's just how it worked out. So I do every book at 28. And I've got, you know, the whole book is scripted. I've got everything mapped out and still scripting as I go. And part of the fun for me is laying out these pages and then, you know, like, oh, and I have an idea as I go. I'm sure I would not be able to do that on a more structured, like with an editor or what have you. But it's so much fun to do it. I don't deviate off the path. It's just a new idea comes in. But I want to have book 6 ready. I'm thinking August. Okay. And hopefully have book 7 ready before the end of the year. I mean, that would be, if I can do that, that would be fantastic. And I do have it planned for 12 issues. It may stretch to 15 because I just think about how much ground I have to cover. And what I don't like to do is chop all of the subplots, is chop them down so much that they seem more trivial. I want to deep dive a little bit more. But hey, if it adds more books, it adds more books, and I'll just keep going. And like I said, it would be great if there's a team at some point that hopefully can expedite the books being created. I don't know. I'm looking for any and all possibilities. So
we'll see how it goes, because 13 is a good number. A lucky number there, so that could work. yeah, that's a good number for that. Of course, 12 is good. You know, a monthly title for a year, you know, basically how people look at it. But that would be good. And if you could collect them all into a nice big volume 1, boy, would that be nice. That would be great stuff. So that's great that you're making all this good progress. And things are going on, because it's a really good story, really something that grips me. You know, I care about the characters. It's one of the things that I think comics sometimes become video games if we don't care about the people. Yeah. But your books are nothing like that. I like I said, that last page in issue 5 got me. And there's other things going on. Of course, Beth, her whole storyline gets to me as well. So there's a lot of interesting things going on with it. And I just...
And some of the items that happen in past lives begin to tie into what's going on in the modern day line. And you find the characters are a lot more deep. And I'm excited about the notion that all of the characters have really rich backstories that can be explored. So I really like stories that deep dive or just really go in depth with characters and storytelling. So that's what I want to hit, rather than just, let's make every page a splash page. You know?
Right. Now, one of the things I noticed about the book is that the subtitle is called The Order of the Revenant. Do you want to explain what a revenant is?
Well, a revenant, the classic definition is a soul that has returned, or a soul that's still with you, one that's gone and has returned. Mm-hmm. And the reason they use that terminology is this organization is really the protagonist organization, sort of the flip side of the coin from the Nephilim. And they came into existence to combat what the Nephilim are up to, mainly because a lot of the atrocities that have happened in history, some of the terrible dictators who've done terrible things and awful wars where tens of thousands of people died or, you know, whatever you can think of, usually it was Nephilim who were behind it in one way or another. So the Order of the Revenant were an organization formed to try to combat this. And they, in the modern day, they end up being usually involved with some kind of government work or law enforcement, like members of the FBI or the CIA or, you know, Interpol or whatever it may be, and all around the world. And they're not necessarily trying to interfere, but they are trying to tamp down whatever might be planned by the Nephilim. Okay. And it's been pretty quiet for a while, but it's really ramping up right now. So the Order of the Revenant are trying to get a handle on what's going on.
Okay, sounds pretty good. So it's Severed Souls, the Order of the Revenant, and it's out on Comixology, right?
It's on Comixology. I have a Gumroad page, which is just my name, gumroad.com and my name. There's the Patreon account where, you know, you can unlock the pages and get books sent to you. And it's on sale in some Houston comic stores, Bedrock City, Nance Comics Games, and Fun Stuff Comics and Games in Katy. Third Planet, I believe, has some issues. Mm-hmm. But if you do go to the shop and they don't have it, ask them. And I'm happy to put more books out there on the shelf. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I sell a lot of books at conventions. It's my favorite topic. I love talking to people about it at shows.
Very good, very good. Well, that's how I met you. So it got me interested in it to see what you were selling, and I was really interested in the topic. So I highly recommend the book, again, Severed Souls, The Order of the Revenant. And you mentioned that your website is severedsoulsbook.com.
That's it.
And they can order it through there if they need to, or through the Patreon, as you mentioned. Are you on any other social media?
I'm on Instagram, Dimension_comics, and I'm on Facebook. I have a Jay Gillespie art page there, and I have a Dimension Comics page on Facebook, and I have a Twitter page, which is I think J.D. Gillespie Jr. Started a long time ago before I did all this. The email, if you're interested in getting copies, is severedsoulsbook@gmail. You can find me. I'm out there.
All right. Well, I highly recommend it. And, you know, I would keep track of where Jay is. I think it's more fun to go and actually talk to him in face-to-face like we did. And it brings me to a subject that I'm kind of interested in. We had talked about previously the fact that sometimes historical programs on TV inspire us. We were talking about Severed Souls has a lot of basis in some things that you've seen, you know, History Channel type things.
Absolutely. I've always had a real fascination with all things science and history. And so my mom was the same way. Mm-hmm. My mom and I would just, when I was younger, we were usually glued in front of the TV with whatever, you know, really fascinating stuff was on. So I guess I have a natural, you know, inclination to research these things and look into them and find these really fun tie-ins. Yeah. So it definitely touches on those.
I think I mentioned to you once, I was watching a show about in the UK, they were talking about that there was a black book that Hitler's forces had put together, included people that when the Nazis took over in the UK, the people they were going to get rid of. And yeah. I didn't know such a thing existed. I remember just looking at the screen going like, wow, I didn't know this. And they started listing some of the names, and a lot of them were names that you know. And they, of course, most of them were people that were the highly intelligent people, the talented people. Those are the ones they wanted to get rid of. So I was stunned. I was just shocked when I saw
it. And I think there's a lot of examples in history where it's just eye-opening, stunning, because we think, you know, in terms of 21st century morality, I suppose, and in the past, things were radically different. And wow, so history can be pretty amazing, which is, you know, all part of the what's fun to tie it into good and bad, you know.
Well, Jay, this is wonderful stuff, I have to say, and I highly encourage people to track this good book down and get into it, because it's definitely worth reading and definitely, I think, worth collecting.
Awesome.
So I get to the Patreon page. I think that's a good thing, too, because anything that along those lines will help make this book continue going, and I really want to see this move forward. So keep it up, awesome. Jay. I think it's terrific.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate it very much. Thank you for the interview and the kind words, and I look forward to doing it again sometime in the future.
And that's it for this week. Be back next episode when I'll have another terrific conversation with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.